Hey, folks, you're listening to Chew the Fat with Craig Hartman, the podcast that cuts through, hopefully, the public persona of successful, driven chefs and chews right through the fat and gets into the meat, or let's say into the head of the chef. And folks, really what we're trying to do here is we want you to actually feel like it's you, that maybe you're sitting down with someone you admire, and maybe it's not even a chef that you would think of. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just someone that you admire. You get to ask them, you know, what happened, man? How did you do this? How did you become successful? And that's what we hope we get out of this. And we hope that you feel it's you talking to this person, and that it's, you know, it's an intimate, deep conversation with someone that, you know, you're inspired by. And so that's really it. That's what Chew the Fat is all about. And tonight we have Tucker Yoder, Chef Tucker Yoder. How you doing tonight?
Good.
Cool. Tucker is the chef at Clifton Inn, which is a Relay and Chateau hotel in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Relay and Chateau is a kind of like a fraternity or a club of very passionate, upscale inns and restaurants. In fact, one of my favorite chefs has a Relay and Chateau restaurant, Daniel, in New York City. So you can see the kind of the company that Tucker is hanging out with these days.
Trying to
hang out with these guys, but it's a tall order. Also, in Little Washington is Relay and Chateau, and among many other places. So, Tucker, tell us a little bit about your background. Now, when I say that, you know, just give us kind of how your journey, where your journey started, not how it started, but just give us kind of the roadmap up to Clifton Inn.
I guess you have to start where I started cooking when my mom was sick when I was a teenager.
Wow.
So I started cooking, and then it started with ski resorts and stuff like that, and then eventually culinary school, Boar's Head, Charlottesville, OXO, you know, brief stint at Clifton before, and then left and did a couple other things and came back.
And here you are. You're back. So I read a couple things about you. You did a couple cool stages, I know. Clio, Oranger, Chef Oranger. I had some great meal there. So you know, I know you had these things like that. Also the Ryland Inn, another chef named Craig, like Craig, me. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's cool. Craig Shelton. And you ended up working for one of my favorite people in the world, John Haywood at OXO. And John's kind of like a madman. I think he was the closest thing I ever got to, like, to Marco Pierre White.
Yeah, that was definitely his, where he was going.
Yeah,
he calmed down, though, after a while.
Yeah. Do you know I performed his wedding ceremony?
Yep.
Yeah.
He dropped the ring down the...
Oh, man, he told you the whole story, didn't he? Well, we'll keep that for another time. Actually, maybe we'll talk to John. But in some of the things I read about you, they said extraordinary preparations, raw talent, hip, chic, innovative but approachable. And, you know, these are pretty nice things. Do you feel, you know, as you've gotten to this area, do you feel like these are things that you want people to think about you and your food? Like hip, chic, approachable.
Sure. But I mean, I think ultimately we want to cook with what's seasonal and what's, and just because that's hip and chic now, it's kind of
may not be hip and chic later.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's interesting because we're doing these things now, and we used to do these things at OXO, and I mean, you used to do those things.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. You know, so at Clifton, when you were at Clifton, you know, it's like, you know, it's getting back to something, and it's.
So let me ask you this then real quick. Do you think that some of the things that are trendy right now, do you feel like they're really trendy right now, or do you feel like they've been around for a long time?
Well, I think good restaurants have been doing some of these things for a very long time, you know, sourcing the best they can from somewhere close by where they can be in touch with the person who's providing it to them, and, you know, whether it be beef or pork or vegetables or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a chance to talk to John back in the day, and John called me one time, John Haywood from OXO, and he said, hey, you know, I got this guy looking for a job right now, and he is, this is what John said about you. He said he is the best raw cook and talented person in the kitchen I've ever had, and you could probably fire half your crew. This is what he told, you know, John, you probably fire half your crew because Tucker is a workhorse. And, you know, it didn't quite work out at that time. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to work with you, but you ended up at the opening the Red Hen in Lexington, which, you know, got a lot of accolades for how you yourself interacted with farmers. And tell me about some of the people that you've met farm-wise, you know, and the way you've created these relationships.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a great experience as far as meeting. You know, I met Charlie Potter, who raises pigs, raises cows, and now he owns the slaughterhouse or the processing plant.
Mm-hmm.
So he does everything from feed them when they're babies to kill them and cut them. And that's great. You know, I can call him up and say, this is exactly what I want.
Folks, he said kill them and cut them. I think that's awesome. So, you know, you meet this guy like Charlie Potter. Did you... When, you know, as a chef, do you actually get a chance to go out and, like, you know, see these people, like, at their farm? Or you just wait for them to come to you?
Right. Well, I was lucky enough there to have free time before we opened to go out and meet these people face-to-face. And it over there, it a lot of those places hadn't been tapped, you know, hadn't been... They sold through Polyface, they sold through some other distributorship.
Sure. Yeah.
And they hadn't had the chef come out to the farm and say...
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great the way you're doing that. That's
how do they respond to you when you go there? I mean, these farmers, because if they haven't really, if you were one of the first maybe chefs that have been to their farms, how did they respond? Are they, you know, they put off by you? Or
Charlie is a natural salesman. So as soon as you went to Charlie's farm, he's trying to sell you the whole cow before you even walked across his property line. So, you know, that was a fun experience. There were a couple other places that were a little, you know, oh, we've had chefs call us before and they've said they're going to do this, said they're going to do that, but haven't come through. So, you know, we had a couple of vegetable farms that we went to and said, we want you to grow these things. And they're like, well, we've grown stuff for people before and they haven't taken them. It's like, well, grow it and we'll take everything.
Yeah.
And once we said that, and once we went out there, we helped people build hoop houses. We helped people weed. We helped people pull up vegetables. We did whatever. They start understanding that that's what we wanted.
And trust,
I still have
right?
Those, I still have those relationships today, and I call them up and say, when are my baby carrots going to be ready? And they say, we've got 35 pounds now. I said, all right, bring them.
Nice. So. Yeah, I think, you know, I guess it's like anything else. You know, you build a little trust with a farmer because they've probably been burnt before. And next thing you know,
I've worked at places where I've said to somebody, we'll buy all those. And the chef will say, no, we won't.
Yeah, well, I remember one time telling a producer of bison when he told me he had 70 head. I said, I'll buy every tenderloin you have. And he stepped back and said, are you crazy? And, yeah, I was a little crazy. But so let me ask you real quick. When actually, we're going to go back now in your life. When did you actually realize in your life that you wanted to be in a kitchen? I mean, were you like born? Did you like just come out of the womb? You're like, whoa, I got to be in the kitchen. Where did it happen? What did it happen?
I don't know. I mean, I can honestly say, I mean, it sounds a little bit like BS, but when I was working at OXXO, this is a true experience. I tasted my first fresh pea at 25 years old.
Yeah.
My mom was never much of a cook. And at that point, I'd been working in a kitchen for about 10 years. So it was like,
mm-hmm.
to have that epiphany and be like, oh, I guess I can do this forever.
Yeah.
You know? To that point, I was probably like a lot of other people, a lot of other line cooks in the world being like, oh, I'll do this until something else.
Sure. Well, let me ask you then, you fell into cooking kind of by mistake then? I mean, or not mistake,
right.
But you
well,
just
no,
needed
you know,
a job?
It was one of those things in high school, you know, washing dishes and doing menial prep and, you know, moving to the beach for the summer and working in a pizza place and, you know, picking up the basics. I like to cook.
Yeah.
You know, I was, I guess, a foodie. You know, I watched TV, watched a lot of PBS, you know, Frugal Gourmet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Read a ton of cookbooks, read Food and Wine and Gourmet and stuff like that all the time. And got into it as a teenager, but never thought that was going to be what I'd do.
Yeah, so. But then you had an epiphany.
You had to be a lawyer or something.
Wow. That would have been something else. So you think this your kind of journey came by accident? Then you ended up at OXO,
right? Right. I mean, and, I definitely
got inspired by what John did, probably.
Yeah, there. I mean, there was some of that, and you know, it was just we started moving towards using the farmers market, and utilizing people from there, and getting these super fresh ingredients, and it's like the taste of fresh pea compared to one that's ancient or the one that's frozen or one that's in a can is a world's of difference. So
yeah, true enough.
It's just kind of like, wow, why doesn't my mom like peas? You know, what can I do to this pea to make my mom like it?
You remember like when perfect. People used to say peas are poison?
Yeah.
You eat a fresh pea, it's like, oh my God. So speaking of John Haywood, what most influenced you about that experience working at OXO? I mean,
his drive is unbelievable. I mean, he's nonstop.
Yeah.
And he was 5 years older, 6 years older than me. And you'd walk in the kitchen, he'd already been there for 2 hours, and you'd get done, and he'd still be there cleaning with you. You know, it's just impressive. He's just nonstop. And when we all started working there, it was like he was under the philosophy of you get here when you need to get all your stuff done perfectly, you know, the way we want it done.
Yeah.
So it was like if you needed to work a 15-hour day, you worked 15-hour day. If you only need to work a 6-hour day, which never happened.
Yeah,
you worked a 6-hour day. You know, and he would be right there next to you. He wouldn't be one of these people that would like come in and talk all this talk and then go down to his office and do whatever. He'd be there the whole time, which was impressive.
True enough.
Still, I mean, thinking back on it now, even now, like every now and again, I'll take an hour and go do something else, and come back to the kitchen and get back to work. It's like, John never took those hours, you know?
Yeah. So. That sounds like good inspiration. Or any other experiences on your way to Clifton that you can look back to that you think had an influence, like just little things here and there, a chef, a restaurant manager, just something that's
right.
There.
I mean, everything. I mean, you spoke about Ryland Inn. I mean, they had a 2-acre garden and tons of fruit trees and nut trees and all around the property that they utilized in the kitchen. And all the cooks in there knew what everything was. They were like, go out there every day. If they needed herbs for their station, they knew where in the garden to find it. They knew who the gardener was. They talked to the gardener. You know, they knew who all the dishwashers are. I mean, it's amazing. You get into these bigger places, there's, I don't know, like 15 people on the line.
Sure, yeah.
And they knew everybody. They knew they do the daytime dishwashers, they knew the prep guys. Everybody knew everybody. It wasn't like,
sure,
there was no disconnect. It was very communal, which is impressive.
Is that how you run your kitchen now at
Clifton? We try.
Yeah.
We try and get everybody involved in everything. We're working on the garden now, and everybody's out there doing that, kind of on a volunteer basis.
Does that mean you don't pay them?
That's right.
Oh, boy, here we are.
But it's for the betterment of the, I mean, we look at it.
Well, let me ask you real quick, when you say betterment, when you were young and you were coming up and, obviously you had a passion. If someone said to you, if a chef said to you, hey, we're going to go, help this farmer, we're going to pick some vegetables. You didn't in your heart say, well, are you going to pay me? I'm going to clock in, right?
Never.
Yeah, because I think people were passionate about it. They're searching for. These things that are
There's always extras. You gotta, maybe it's not payment, but maybe it's, all right, we're sitting here having some of this farmer's home brew and eating these fantastic vegetables, having a killer potluck while we're building a hoop house.
Yeah, yeah.
That's better than money.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds good.
And knowing that I can bring my kids out to that farm anytime I want and let them run around and do whatever while I hang out with the farmer.
Yeah, true.
That's another.
True. Well, let me ask you this then. Talking about doing things and, your passion, you were a runner. You told me you were a runner in college. How did sports impact you in the way that you might run your kitchen? Did it impact you in your work ethic or anything? Is there anything that sports did that helps you in the kitchen?
Yeah, I definitely think there's some adrenaline thing to working in the kitchen for sure. I can't, not tangible, but
Did you have any coaches that you like emulate their style, like when you're
I doubt that, but
yeah. Yeah, I always wondered about that. I think sometimes I feel like Joe Paterno in the Joe Paterno
not the recent Joe Paterno.
The Joe Paterno of the kitchen. What do you think, there's like any special attribute that you might have I don't know what it might be, but is there anything that you think that as you've been in the kitchen that you feel like has helped you? Something that you've put your, you know, that you could put your finger on and say, you know, I got this, I don't need any sleep, or like some, it could be
I
that.
Have four
or
kids,
it could be,
I don't need any sleep anyway.
What do you think? Anything?
I think I'm pretty calm most of the time, which really helps, especially when it's, you know, I may not be the greatest fish cook or meat cook or veg cook, but when it's all raining down on us, I can keep pretty calm, keep pretty organized on what needs to get done.
Yeah, I think that is that's a big deal. Have you ever had your blood pressure taken, like in the middle of the night? I had that once. Yeah, in the middle of a crazy kind of catering party for about 800 people. It was actually for an opening of a hospital, and they took my blood pressure, and my blood pressure was like normal, and they just couldn't believe it. So I always thought maybe that's one of my attributes. Yeah. You know, I'm able to stay calm. So I think that's a good attribute. What about well, like, for instance, I received an email from you at 1:37 in the morning. All right. And I know you have a baby that has to be less than a month old.
Yeah, she's she'll be 3 weeks. 3 weeks.
So do you actually sleep? I mean, it's a big deal.
I'm a pretty good sleeper. I get 5 hours, 6 hours.
Yeah.
But,
so,
you know, I don't. If I need to do something first thing in the morning, it's better for me to stay up till like 2 or 3 and then wake up with a few hours of sleep and get going, rather than try and get a full 8 hours. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I definitely don't sleep enough.
How many hours do you work right now in your job? And I'm not asking you this because so that, you know, Clifton Inn can get in trouble, because there has been, if you notice recently, some class action lawsuits against companies that people are on salary.
I knew what I was getting
myself
into.
Here's what I say when people tell that to me. It's like, look, I make my own schedule, and I go there as much as I need to be there. So I make my own schedule, so I can't blame this on anyone. But really, because you know, somebody might be listening to this who is thinking about going to chef school, or you know, someone who's working as a chef de partie. You know, really, how many hours do you think you put in a week?
I'd say 12 hours is a short day.
Yeah. Do you feel guilty
as far as
work 8 hours?
A little bit.
Yeah, I have that.
If I work 6 days a week and my sixth day I only work 8 hours, I kind of feel like, oh, sorry guys. You know, I mean, it extends past being there. You know, it's if I go home and we need to do some things for the kitchen, I'm thinking about what needs to be changed on the menu, what needs to be ordered, stuff like that. It's not like it stops as soon as I get home.
So, do you live food? Do you think it's more of a lifestyle than it is just a job?
You know, I don't know. I think more like we love food at our house for sure, but I'm able to kind of tune it out for a little bit and play football or play soccer. But yeah, it's always there. I mean, we've got a huge floor to ceiling bookshelf full of cookbooks, and my kids all want to cook all the time and want to come to work with me. And, I mean, it's definitely something I think about a lot.
Well, yeah,
a lot more than other things.
That reminds me, I want to ask you this. I noticed you have a blog, Humble Chef Blogspot.
Blogspot.com.
Humble Chef. And I was checking it out, and I see that you did a little traveling recently.
Yeah.
You son of a, you know what?
That was one of the best. I was actually talking about that with some diners tonight. It was one of the best.
Yeah, so tell us real quick where you went and the restaurants that you ate at.
I went to Copenhagen. And I ate it.
Which is a hotbed right now.
I ate at Noma, which is the best restaurant in the world, with the pastry chef. From Noma. So there's 5 of us, and that was a blast. I mean, it was an unbelievable experience. And I ate at 3 other restaurants, Herman, AOC, and Geranium. And Geranium's Rasmus just won the Bocuse d'Or.
Yeah.
So
that's unbelievable.
He had the bronze and the silver, and now he's got the gold sitting there in the kitchen with him. I ate 45 courses in one day. That was a little much. After flying for whatever it was, 18 hours.
Like that day you got there, you ate 45
courses. With the chef de cuisine for Rick Bayless's places.
That's a special attribute right there, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I flew to
Wine
Italy
and beer too.
to see my son recently, and Yeah, I think I went to sleep as soon as I got there. So
I would have, but they wouldn't let me in my hotel room. So I started walking around.
Oh, that's unbelievable. That's cool. So tell me, do you think that's now we're going to ask, as a successful chef, you work really hard to come up with recipes, or not recipes, but menus and items that will kind of keep you in the forefront or be like cutting edge. How exactly do you come up with these things? Where do they come? Come on. They got to come from somewhere. You know, are you in the shower? Are you like, you know?
I mean, a million different places. You know, it could be from reading an article about something. It could be from, you know, we found this weird green growing on the stone wall in Clifton, and I tried it, and it seems like it's not going to hurt us, so I'm going to find out what it is. And
Did you have a picture of that on your blog?
No, but I have a picture on my phone.
Okay.
I put it on the blog.
Okay.
If it turns out to be edible, we'll put it on there.
How much of it did you eat? No, you still...
I'm fine. But no, I mean, it comes from so many different places. I mean, it could come from a conversation with somebody. It could come from some fantastic barbecue. You know, it's like you never know where, you know, something's going to come from.
So are there any particular chefs that you're following on a daily basis, weekly basis, that are inspiring you right now? Anybody that comes to...
All the guys in... I mean, Sean Brock and McCready is what he's doing now. I really enjoy that. I staged down there before we opened Red Hen.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Rene Redzepi in Copenhagen.
Right.
I think his food's... His food, what I came away from his eating at his place was, it's just very singular.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't have that. You couldn't put that meal somewhere else, and it wouldn't make sense.
Right.
So to have that kind of experience, and I've eaten a lot of different places, to have that kind of experience and just be like, holy shit, I could never eat this anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty cool. So if you can transfer that to some, you know, if you can take your food and do that and have people be like, I can't imagine eating this anywhere else.
What is it that you want people who come to Clifton that eat to think when they leave?
I just want people to have a good time.
As long as they have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, if they have a good time, if we can do our best for them, you know, ultimately it's still the Clifton, so we need to cater to the guest, you know, 100%. So
mm-hmm.
you know, we do what they want. If they want steamed chicken and steamed vegetables, that's what they get.
Yeah, well, you know, you are part of your land chateau, so you better take care of those.
Exactly.
You better take care of those guests. But I think
take care of everybody.
Is there anything like in the culinary world right now that's really turning you on? Any kind of style of cooking, or
I mean, I love everybody getting back to things like making their own charcuterie and using more offal and mm-hmm. things like that. Because of course, as chefs, we love all that stuff. You know,
for the foodie that doesn't know what offal is. Why don't you tell them?
You know, kidneys, hearts, brains.
All the good stuff.
You know, all the stuff that everyone's been throwing away for the past 5-6 years, you know, finally get to use it again.
Yeah. So. I happen to be a huge fan of Scrapple. I'm a Scrapple maniac. If I could have Scrapple every day.
Have you been to the Reading Terminal for the Scrapple Fest?
No.
You got to go. We'll go this year.
All right.
We'll make a podcast field trip.
The Scrapple Fest. Man, we could go to the Scrapple Fest and we could talk to the Scrapple makers. I'll tell you, I love Scrapple.
I'm a big Scrapple fan, too.
And I think, have you ever made haggis?
No.
Yeah. The first time I made a haggis, you know, I tasted it and I realized that it had the same kind of flavor profile of Scrapple, that doesn't have any seasoning. So I seasoned it like Scrapple and served it, and the Scottish people pronounce it the greatest haggis in the world. And basically it was Scrapple flavored haggis. So there you go. Anything that upsets you, like in the food world right now, anything that, you know, some food that you don't like, or trends that you think are really crappy?
Yes. Everything. No, I don't know. I it's hard for me to say, because, you know, like the prevalence of, you know, PR people and how much press can skew things. You know, I was one of those people when I was old enough to start appreciating restaurants better, I would
sure
get that Food and Wine Best New Chef and be like, oh, this one's in Philly, or this one's in Jersey,
right,
this one's in, I can go here. I can go check this place out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in the beginning it was like, oh, these places were really top notch and the best restaurants in the area. Now it's kind of like, are they?
Well, you know, you got to give the press a little break because they're trying to do their job,
right? No,
and they got to keep writing.
Yeah,
so they got to find things.
And I can't disrespect. I have a line cook who worked for one of the biggest PR companies in the country, and of course we employ a PR company. So it's...
Sure. So you don't want to badmouth them too
too bad.
It's just, well, you know, I always liked where people, you know, talking right now, farm to table as a trend. You know, how it's so new and fresh. And I think, you know, it upset me a little bit, but I started really thinking about it. And I think the new part of it is the sustainability.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we used to do all this, but we never talked about sustainability. We just talked about doing really good food, and sustainability is a huge deal. And being able to really back up our local farmers and help them, you know, make a living and as they give us things. So I think that's new. And I think what you've been doing, you know, the things that I've read about you, and I know, you know, what you're doing at Clifton, you're supportive of that. And that's cool. And I think people are very appreciative of that. And yeah, I agree with you on the public persona. That's why I'm doing Chew the Fat, because the public persona of people sometimes is not really true. And I actually haven't met anybody yet in our interviews that's a total ego driven person, and I think you seem to be as humble as your blog says, which is kind of cool. If you were talking to someone right now, if you were talking to a kid going to chef school, someone who's thinking about leaving the, you know, as a dental hygienist to, you know, get in the food business, or someone who's really thinking about opening a restaurant, like any of these people, because they're all passionate and they all really have it. I mean, you've seen a lot of emotional people coming into this. What kind of things can you tell them that would help, that you've learned in your journey?
Just make sure you know what you're getting into.
Eyes wide open.
Spend some time. You know, I've actually had a couple high school kids recently come by and ask to come and, you know, stage in the kitchen and work for free. And it's like, all right, that's a good idea. You know, they asked my opinion on culinary school, and I say it's for some people, it's not for some people. You know, you need to come in and see what it's like before you want to spend that money. That's for sure. You gotta walk in there, know what you're getting yourself into. You know,
are you still paying for your culinary school?
Well, I dropped out after first year, so.
So you're all paid up.
I'm paid up for the first year, and they actually reimbursed me for the second year after I dropped out halfway through.
Wow.
So that was very nice of them to do that. And I'm on the alumni page, so that works too.
Wow. So we're not going to name the school so they don't get upset, but it's the other school. Just kidding. Yeah. I happen to be a CIA grad. And
it is the other school. That's
we call it the other school, NECI. And we've had a NECI grad in already for an interview. Speaking of that, what is your favorite meal of all time? Noma? Or... is there something else? Was
hard,
it your grand something your grandmother made?
My grandmother was not much of a cook. that's one amazing thing. You know, my dad grew up adopted in a big farm family, and we had big, huge dinners, potlucks all the time. So
yeah,
that's kind of what I'm used to. And my mom's family didn't cook much until my grandmother passed away. My grandfather started cooking. That's a whole other story. So family, there wasn't much really, outstanding food. I mean, it's hard to say. You know, I've had great meals at, you know, the taco stand in San Diego down the street from my sister's apartment because you're just hanging out, having a good time, drinking a few beers, eating fish tacos. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, Noma was obviously a fantastic experience. Per se was a fantastic experience. You know, it's more about the experience. Straight up food, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. There are some great dishes out there that I've had. And remember, you know,
my wife drives
crazy. I'll be like, do you remember that, you know, sweetbread dish we had in 1999? She'll be like, no. Do you remember what you said to me last night? No.
No. And so look, you're at Clifton, you know, people would look at you as a successful chef, you know. How do you feel? Do you feel like you're having success? Do you, or do you have this nagging feeling that you're not successful, or just, you know, are you, how do you feel about all this?
There's always more. There's always something else. You know, Clifton, yeah. That's a great, it's a great position. I love it. I'm happy with it. I have a great team working for me now, and we're doing some really good things. I think we're moving in the right direction to do the food we all want to do. I mean, I think it's a very, we're very team-oriented kitchen for sure. You know, we all sit down at the end of the night and talk about dishes we want to change and things we want to do. We're all working on the garden together. We're all, you know, looking for different sources. You know, it's not just me out there trying to find different farms. It's
right.
Everybody. So I think, you know, I'm in a good, definitely in a good place for me right now. But you know, there's always more. You always want to.
Are you looking for Michelin stars? Are you looking for? Are you looking to for people to make pilgrimages to you like you made to Noma?
I mean, that, of course, that would be nice, but
if it happens, it happens.
It happens. I'm not out there.
Well, how do you think it does happen? I mean, what? Tell me what you think the difference is between a chef that people make a pilgrimage to, Ferran Adrià, or the, you know, the Le Calandre and Mastrino or Noma, and Copenhagen. What is it about those places and those chefs? Do you think that's really propelled them? Because this is a question I think a lot of people have. Because that is not all. That's not all press, though, right?
Yeah.
You know, you talked about press, how they really, you know, they kind of skew some things. But this isn't all press. I mean, this is for real. So what do you think it is?
I mean, I think it's being able to communicate that passion to the people who come in to the restaurant. So it makes, you know, the one thing about Noma, it was a very, like, everybody was into everything. You know, all the front of the house people knew everything that was going on in the kitchen. All the kitchen people were out there serving food and understood the wines you were getting poured. And it was a very, very, you know, holistic approach to a restaurant. You know, very, everybody's into it. And with that kind of passion, I think people come in, and whether it be a reporter or be some blogger that's writing about it, you know, people pick up on that. And I think that elevates whole places and whole restaurants.
Do you feel like you can, you know, because you had this experience, this is something that's, I think, really important, you know, for you. You have this experience, now you're at Clifton. How do you really try to take that experience and give it to the staff? I mean,
I mean, yeah,
to the front of the house, the back of the house, and
I think if you come in, you know, the passion and the drive can be contagious. You know, if you surround yourself with the right people, and you know, I know I have, you know, guys working for me now who are texting me and calling me all the time saying we should be doing this, we should be doing this, and I said, you know, we're turning the Titanic, we're not turning a speedboat. You know,
yeah.
We got to take our time.
Be careful what you call that place. I've interviewed some other people. Just kidding.
Yeah, we've got to get, you know, yeah, it's
maybe the Queen Mary.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting, it's not that anything was wrong. It's just,
I wasn't trying to bait you there.
Right,
I'm just saying.
It's just, there is a lack of the unity, I think.
Sure.
Between everybody. And it's a big place, and there are a lot of people, so it's...
You know, I remember that place when there were three employees. I'm not going to name their names, but...
no naming names.
I remember when there were three employees. Anyway, you know, as we finish up here, you have this great family now. How many children?
Four
children. How's your work-life balance? Are you able to deal with this? Do you get any flack from home or anything?
Oh, I get tons of flack from home.
Welcome to the club, buddy. Welcome to the... No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I try
honey, I love you.
I try and balance it because I like to ride my bike a lot, too. So it's... Yeah, you know, I got home last night, and I was home kind of early. I was like, all right, great. I'm going to hop on my bike when I get home and ride on the trainer for a little bit. Just so once the weather gets better, I can start going first thing in the morning.
Sure.
My wife was awake when I got home, and I was like, I should really sit here and spend some quality time with my wife instead.
Yeah.
You know, you make the best of the time you have. Sure. And they know that you do what you do because, one, you're passionate about, and two, that pays the bills.
Yeah. Had you ever fantasized about having, like, that job, you know, like being a lawyer? And I know young lawyers work their asses off, so I'm not saying they don't. But, you know, have you ever fantasized about having, like, that real job?
No.
I call it a real job. That's what people say to me all the time. Have you ever thought about having a real job?
My closest thing to being at, you know, thinking outside of the kitchen or a restaurant or an inn was what we talked about the other day, being a farmer. You know,
yeah,
having everybody right there and everybody's working together to sustain the family.
So do you have a personal goal like that? I mean, do you have a goal? I mean, something you really
I have no
you're
goals,
really thinking
and that's
about?
The thing I keep telling young cooks. Make sure you have goals.
But you don't have any?
No.
That's awesome.
I mean, I do. You know, obviously, we want to be successful and be able to retire someday. But you know, if
that's
I retire
awesome.
And open a barbecue joint, that'd be good, too.
So, anything else? If you had anything else you wanted to say to anybody listening?
No. I got nothing.
There it is. You're listening to the humble chef, Tucker Yoder. And, folks, again, you're listening to Chew the Fat with Craig Hartman. And, you know, what we hope you get out of these interviews is a sense of who the chef is when you go to eat that meal. That when you get the food on the plate, you look at it and you know the heart and you know really what inspires these folks. And you're not just there to have a meal. You're there to really see that there's actually someone in the kitchen who cares and who loves what they're doing. And maybe that'll heighten your experience. And so anyway, again, Craig Hartman from Chew the Fat. Look it up, chewfat.net. That's chewfat.net. You can sound out on there if you'd like. So if there's any questions you want me to ask anyone, if you have a chef that you particularly would like to hear from, write that down too. If you think our podcast sucks, let us know that too. If you actually, I don't want to hear that. No, it really serious. If you do, let us know what we could do better.
It's called constructive criticism.
Yeah. Constructive criticism. Anyway, again, you had Tucker Yoder tonight from Clifton Inn. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you later.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. I wasn't gonna sing the song tonight, or this decade, but I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that that it came out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, and there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one, till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile would be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. To just wanted to know if you had any information about it. And I said, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie.